Hello, I'm Mercedes Stevenson, and you're listening to The West Block. Violence and chaos like this aren't new for Haiti, but this time the situation is actually quite different. And it's worse. There's no longer a president after the interim leader was forced to resign after 2 years without elections and increasing gang violence. He had replaced the previous president, who was assassinated. What few military and police are left in the country have turned from trying to quell violence between rival gangs, some of which are as well armed as small militaries, to facing a new threat. Instead of fighting each other, the gangs have joined together, forming a criminal alliance that plans on being a dominant force in the country. The leader of the most powerful gang in the country, a man named Jimmy Barbecue Cherouzé, who used to be a police officer, had a warning for those who plan to intervene.
Et communauté internationale, spécialement les États-Unis, le Canada, la France, corps groupe là, y a responsable tout le monde qui a mouru dans le pays d'Haïti.
The deteriorating security situation in the country's capital means many Haitians are facing famine while flights can't get in or out. And embassies, including Canada's, have evacuated much of their non-essential staff. Canada's ambassador to Haiti, André-François Giroux, however, is still in Port-au-Prince, and he joins us now. Ambassador, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time for us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I imagine you are in the middle of what is an extraordinarily chaotic, violent, and dangerous situation on the ground. Can you describe to Canadians what is happening in Haiti right now and what it's like to be there?
Well, one thing that we have to keep in mind is that Haiti has been facing these three crises, humanitarian, political, and security, for quite a few years now. When it comes to security, so this has been ongoing, but the reality is what we've seen these past few weeks is the gang, instead of just, you know, creating terror and pursuing their business model, which has been traditionally to kidnap people, to traffic drugs, and just, you know, ask people for security, payment for security. What we've seen is them working together, coordinating and attacking, targeting some of the key infrastructure, the airport, the port, police commissariat. As a response to all of this, the police has been doing a tremendous job, and it has regained some control over the port, is trying to rebuild a security perimeter around the airport. But the reality is the PNH is not as strong as it should be. It needs to rebuild itself. That's why we've been investing in the PNH, assisting with them. But, you know, this is the reality on the ground right now. And obviously that creates a lot of uncertainty. And for that reason, people are a little more nervous and need to be much more careful.
It is a very different situation to be talking about dealing with criminal gangs who want to seize power. We're used to dealing sometimes with very violent governments or extremists, but this is a bit of a unique situation. Can you explain to us who some of the key players are who are joining together to try to essentially, I don't know if I want to say seize power, I'm not sure they're looking to govern, but they're certainly looking to be the most powerful force in Haiti, that are these extremely sophisticated gangs?
Yes. Some people may ask, why do we see the gangs working together now and not, you know, 6 months ago? Because their modus operandi has been more or less fighting each other to control respective territories. But de facto Prime Minister Henri was trying to do was trying to create the conditions for a multinational security force to come. And that's not good news for the gangs, as you can imagine. So the gangs are very worried that, and then right now what we're seeing is they're trying to really make their territory even stronger and try to prevent this multinational force to come. Very opportunistically, some political leaders have associated themselves with the gangs and are, for their own benefit, trying to mobilize the gangs and say, we're going to take power, we're going to create security because we have this alliance with the gangs. And then if you put us in power, we will run the country and restore security. The Haitian people are not fools. They don't want a government, a country run by former criminals that are associated with gangs leader.
And I think that most people would think that that certainly sounds like a better option. But How do you install that when you don't have quite literally the firepower necessarily to back that against gangs who in some cases have been assessed at having near peer combat capabilities to parts of the Canadian military?
Yes, it is challenging, and we expect that as this government of national unity forms itself, the gangs will do everything to make it fail and create insecurity to prevent the multinational security force to come. The government that Haitians are trying to put together will have a two main mandate, which will be to create a clear path towards elections and welcome the multinational security force. So yes, the gang will continue to create insecurity. The police is doing, again, a tremendous job, but it needs reinforcement, and that's why that multinational mission needs to come as soon as possible. We, Canada, over the past year and a half, we've identified this as a critical issue, and that's why Prime Minister Trudeau a year ago announced $100 million just dedicated to support the national police in equipment, training, technical expertise. In addition to that $100 million, we've also mobilized the international community.
Canada has supported Haiti verbally. But when it's come down to it, when President Biden wanted Canada to lead the multinational force in Haiti, we declined. There has been deep concern from the leadership of the Canadian Armed Forces and of the RCMP that the risk was simply too high. The Haitian police who were training were not even going to Haiti to train them. We're pulling them out to train them in a third-party country because the risk was associated as being so high. So it seems like Canada is saying all the right things, but it seems like when there's a risk to take on, to actually get involved, there's hesitancy there. Do you think that's true?
No, I think we have to be realistic about our own capacity and what we are doing is really playing on our strength, providing something that is definitely needed. Training in a third country or training in Haiti, I think what's the most important here is that the training goes on, and then there's merit to do it in a third location so that trainees can really focus on their training. I can assure you that when the conditions are there, we will be training doing training in Port-au-Prince as well. But right now, that was deemed to be more opportunistic, I guess, or more logistical. But all to say that we are definitely using our own capacity and expertise to really support where we can make a difference.
I know that a number of your staff have been pulled out because of concerns about security. You have bravely stayed behind to try to assist Canadian citizens. Do you believe that you are going to be able to stay in the embassy, or do you think it's likely that you're going to have to evacuate essential staff out of Haiti completely?
You know, we have to be ready for every eventuality, but the last thing we want to do is close our embassy and leave.
Are you living in the embassy compound right now to be able to stay safe? I'm noticing the shutters closed behind you, and I'm sure there's a number of security precautions you have to take.
I won't disclose my location, but I can assure you that I'm well equipped. I have water, food, and good security. So I'm not worried for my own personal safety. I mean, we have to be careful. We reduce our movements on the ground as much as we can. But we are very much here operational and we're carrying on with the work that we have to do.
Ambassador, the United States obviously has considerable military strength in the region, both in terms of ability to intervene, respond, and potentially rescue their embassy staff. Canada does not have that same strength. Would you like to see military assets from the Canadian Armed Forces in the region or special forces deployed to the embassy to help to protect you?
As I had a chance to explain before, we are making every contingency plan, and I take great comfort knowing that the U.S. is well-tooled here as well and is a good ally, and Miami is not too far. But I would say for the time being, we're definitely ready for every opportunity or every occasion. And we are, as you can imagine, coordinating very closely with all of our good allies in the region.
What advice do you have for Canadians who are in Haiti right now? I know they've been told to shelter in place, but obviously this is an extremely dangerous and stressful situation. Is the government of Canada able to offer them anything more than that?
Well, right now, and please keep in mind that our travel advisory for the last year and a half has been don't come to Haiti. If you are in Haiti, it's time to leave and go back home. So the people, the Canadians that are here are here because they know the lay of the land. They know what to expect. So, and I know they're very resilient. Our advice is shelter in place. Make sure that you have reserve of water, food, medicine, like I do. And don't move around unless you really have to.
Certainly our wish for you too. We know events don't always comply with that, but we thank you for joining us and we wish you the very best. Please stay safe and we appreciate your service.
Thank you very much.
On a night cold enough to freeze your bones, a prospector searching for a legendary cursed gold mine vanishes without a trace. I'm Crew Williams, the host of Dead Man's Curse. This season, we retrace the steps of fortune seekers looking for a motherlode worth billions who never came back. Join our quest June 3rd. Search for and follow Dead Man's Curse Volcanic Gold on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
There have been many efforts to help Haiti in the past, but most have not gone well. In 2004, the UN force MINISTA was established and quickly known for rapes and extrajudicial killings. In 2005, a massacre of Haitians by Brazilian soldiers working for the UN. And in 2010, Haiti's first cases of cholera killed at least 10,000 after UN peacekeepers arrived from Nepal, where the disease is common. And there are many more examples. So how can the UN help this time without repeating history's mistakes? Canada's ambassador to the United Nations, Bob Rae, joins us now. Ambassador, nice to see you, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to see you again, too, Mercedes. Good to be with you.
Ambassador Rae, what is the situation in terms of trying to secure the situation on the ground in Haiti and this external force that is still supposed to be coming in? Is that possible?
Yes, it's possible. The security situation is bad, but it can be remedied. And I personally know that the Haitian National Police have been responding in a remarkable way to protecting state institutions, to pushing back against the gangs, but they simply don't have enough equipment, enough ability to kind of get at it in the major way that's required. And that's why we believe the United Nations agrees that we need a multinational force, which will begin to address the serious deficit that the Haitian National Police faces at the present time. But it can be done. It absolutely can be done. We just have to get the political will, the financial will, and all the other things that are required to get it done. And Canada is very committed to being part of that solution.
Ambassador Rae, one of the reasons I always enjoy speaking with you is because you say things like they are, and you're not afraid to really sort of speak truth to power. It strikes me when we look at Haiti, this is a country that has been through terrible devastation, terrible poverty, terrible violence. It is in our hemisphere, but we don't talk about it very much. We talk about supporting the government, but Canada doesn't want to lead the international mission. We don't actually want to put RCMP or military on the ground, in part because there'd be such a danger to our troops. But that leads me to, well, we've allowed it to get that out of control. Why do you think that Haiti has been largely abandoned by the international community and by North America when it comes to making a serious effort at getting this country rebuilt and their security under control? Do people just not care?
No, actually, I don't think it's about not caring. I think it's about struggling to find a way of supporting the people of Haiti without supporting actors which, frankly, are corrupt and not helping the situation. And I think the challenge has always been that, you know, we come in with massive amounts of money. If you look at what happened after 2010 and the experience after 2010, we came in with a lot of money. Money spilled all over the place. Money was taken over by, you know, some of the ruling families of the country and immediately extorted, went out to Miami or New York or Montreal or somewhere else. And it wasn't used for the benefit of the Haitian people. And I think we've got to avoid that kind of a production at all costs. The other thing is this is urban fighting. This is dealing with urban gangs. And we have to be quite specific and careful about making sure that we do everything possible to extract the kids out of the gangs. And there are countries that are going to be involved in doing this, helping make this happen. But I would like to kind of talk back a little bit to, against your narrative on abandonment. Nobody's abandoned Haiti. Haiti has received billions, tens of billions of dollars from countries in the last 25, 30 years, received a lot of money. And not all that money has been put to good use. And I think we'd be deluding ourselves if we thought that wasn't a problem. So we have to strengthen Haiti's institutions. We have to require accountability. We have to make sure money is going to where it's needed, how it's needed. And we have to make sure that it's not just piled on all of a sudden, because we've got to deal with the long-term development needs of the country with an effective plan that's really going to work. And we are dealing with an unprecedented network of gangsters who are violent, who are very well-entrenched, who are well-armed and well-equipped. And it's going to be a very tough struggle to bring them down.
So how do you operate in that environment then? If you're dealing with these gangsters who there's obviously questionable morality about engaging with them, but they're the guys who seem to have the power right now. You have a government in name that's trying to form, but doesn't have an ability to execute, and a long history of rich politicians sucking money out of the country and redirecting it to their homes in Miami. How do you come into that and find a solution that isn't just the international community taking over and running things for a while? Or is that something we should be looking at, like post-World War II in Japan?
No. I don't think taking over. We've tried that before. I mean, frankly, Mercedes, that's the model that we fell into without really thinking about it. And we can't do that again. That's a mistake. We have to let the Haitian political institutions do the job. We need more cooperation. And one thing we do need, and I have to say this very deliberately, is we need greater effort from the Americans on the export of arms from their country to Haiti. We have to understand that the largest source of guns in Haiti, and frankly in the Caribbean, is the United States of America. And we've talked to the Americans about this. I've been very open in talking to people about it. And there has to be an effort by the United States to reduce the export of arms. The United Nations resolution talked about that very directly. And the statement that was made by the Security Council last week talked very directly about the importance of an arms embargo, and which means that countries like Canada and the United States and the EU and others that have the means to actually enforce an embargo need to enforce the embargo.
What is the consequence regionally and for Canada if we fail in Haiti?
Well, I mean, the way I put it is this, is there are two issues for me. The first one is that the security of any country is only as strong as the weakest link. And the security of any region is only as strong as the weakest link. We have issues of crime in the Caribbean. We have issues of insecurity. We have questions about, you know, how do we build stronger economies, more resilient economies. We need to understand that when things really collapse in Haiti, it has a devastating impact on the region. There's also, I think, a need to recognize that we have a neighbor who's taken some very hard hits, and the people are suffering badly, and they're hurting. And so when people are hurting and are suffering, we have a responsibility to respond and to be helpful. But we also have a responsibility to do it right and to do it in a way that works for them and also works for us, works for everybody. We know it's not going to be easy, but we are definitely not walking away from this situation. Canada has stepped up in a number of ways, and we're going to continue to do it. And frankly, I'm very proud of the fact that over many decades, we have helped.
Ambassador Ray, thank you so much for joining us today, sir. We appreciate it. Now for one last thing. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will have to spend a fair chunk of this coming week defending the planned increase to his signature carbon tax, which is scheduled to kick in on April 1st. Multiple Conservative premiers, from Alberta's Danielle Smith to Ontario's Doug Ford, have called for a pause.
If they don't start putting money back into people's pockets instead of filling their pockets, guess what? They're going to get annihilated, as I said before. They're done. Done like dinner.
Some of Mr. Trudeau's political allies, though, are supporting what those Conservative premiers are saying, including Newfoundland and Labrador's Liberal Premier Anthony Fury. He's encouraging the government to rethink the hike. So far, the pleas are falling on deaf ears. Justin Trudeau has been categoric that there is no plan to slow down or stop. And he says that those who are asking for such a thing are putting popularity over policy.
But my job is not to be popular. My job, although it helps, my job is to do the right things for Canada now and do the right things for Canadians a generation from now. And that's what I've been focused on. And yeah, it's not always popular. But I know that doing the right things today that support people today, that deliver that better future a generation from now, two generations from now, is going to make a huge difference in the path we take forward.
But as April 1st draws closer and Canadians struggle with the cost of living, the tax increase is an easy target for the federal Conservatives, who have a series of political shenanigans planned in the House of Commons to embarrass the Liberals over the increase and are holding rallies across the country.
Axe the tax!
Mr. Trudeau's justifications and explanations, ranging from principled environmentalism to the argument that the rebate puts money back in the pockets of Canadians, have failed to convince people that this is a good idea. So will Mr. Trudeau revisit his insistence that the hike has to go ahead? Well, that might in part depend on whether he's starting to think about his legacy as Prime Minister versus his chances of re-election. That's our show for today. I'm Mercedes Stevenson for the West Block.